When I asked Eleanor Roosevelt how she was able to carry such an exhausting schedule during the 12 years she was in the White House, she said that before meeting a crowd or making a speech, she would often sit in a chair or Davenport, close her eyes, and relax for 20 minutes. I once interviewed Gene Autry in his dressing room at Madison Square Garden, where he was the star attraction at the World's Championship Rodeo. I noticed an army cot in his dressing room. "I lie down there every afternoon," Gene Autry said, "and get an hour's nap between performances. When I'm making pictures in Hollywood," he continued, "I often relax in a big easy chair and get 2 or 3 10-minute naps a day. They buck me up tremendously." Edison attributed his enormous energy and endurance to his habit of sleeping whenever he wanted to. I interviewed Henry Ford shortly before his 80th birthday. I was surprised to see how fresh and fine he looked. I asked him the secret. He said, "I never stand up when I can sit down, and I never sit down when I can lie down." Horace Mann, the father of modern education, did the same thing as he grew older. When he was president of Antioch College, he used to stretch out on a couch while interviewing students. I persuaded a motion picture director in Hollywood to try a similar technique. He confessed that it worked miracles. I refer to Jack Chertok, who was one of Hollywood's top directors. When he came to see me several years ago, he was then head of the short feature department of MGM. Worn out and exhausted, he had tried everything, tonics, vitamins, medicine, nothing helped much. I suggested that he take a vacation a day. How? By stretching out in his office and relaxing while holding conferences with his staff writers. When I saw him again 2 years later, he said, "A miracle has happened. That's what my own physicians call it. I used to sit up in my chair, tense and taut, while discussing ideas for our short features. Now I stretch out on the office couch during these conferences. I feel better than I've felt in 20 years. Work 2 hours a day longer, yet I rarely get tired." How does all this apply to you? If you're a stenographer, you can't take naps in the office, as Edison did, and as Sam Goldwyn did. And if you're an accountant, you can't stretch out on the couch while discussing a financial statement with the boss. But if you live in a small city and go home for lunch, you may be able to take a 10-minute nap after lunch. That is what General George C. Marshall used to do. He felt he was so busy directing the U.S. Army in wartime that he had to rest at noon. If you're over 50 and feel you're too rushed to do it, then buy immediately all the life insurance you can get. Funerals come high, and suddenly these days, and your spouse may want to take your insurance money and marry a younger person. If you can't take a nap at noon, you can at least try to lie down for an hour before the evening meal. It is cheaper than a cocktail, and over a long stretch it is 5,467 times more effective. If you can sleep for an hour around 5, 6, or 7 o'clock, you can add 1 hour a day to your waking life. Why? How? Because an hour's nap before the evening meal, plus 6 hours sleep at night, a total of 7 hours, will do you more good than 8 hours of unbroken sleep. A physical worker can do more work if he takes more time out for rest. Frederick Taylor demonstrated that while working as a scientific management engineer with the Bethlehem Steel Company. He observed that laboring men were loading approximately 12.5 tons of pig iron per man each day on freight cars, and they were exhausted at noon. He made a scientific study of all the fatigue factors involved and declared that these men should be loading not 12.5 tons of pig iron per day, but 47 tons per day. He figured that they ought to do almost 4 times as much as they were doing and not be exhausted. But prove it. Taylor selected a Mr. Schmidt, who was required to work by the stopwatch. Schmidt was told by the man who stood over him with a watch, "Now pick up a pig and walk. Now sit down and rest. Now walk. Now rest." And what happened? Schmidt carried 47 tons of pig iron each day, while the other men carried only 12.5 tons per man. And he practically never failed to work at this pace during the 3 years that Frederick Taylor was at Bethlehem. Schmidt was able to do this because he rested before he got tired. He worked approximately 26 minutes before he got tired. he worked approximately 26 minutes out of the hour and rested 34 minutes. He rested more than he worked, yet he did almost four times as much work as the others. Is this mere hearsay? No, you can read the record yourself on pages 41 through 62 of Principles of Scientific Management by Frederick Winslow Taylor. And let me repeat. Do what the Army does. Take frequent rests. Do what your heart does. Rest before you get tired, and you will add 1 hour a day to your waking life. Chapter 24. What makes you tired, and what you can do about it. Here's an astounding and significant fact. Mental work alone can't make you tired. Sounds absurd, but a few years ago, scientists tried to find out how long the human brain could labor without reaching a diminished capacity for work, the scientific definition of fatigue. To the amazement of these scientists, they discovered that blood passing through the brain when it's active shows no fatigue at all. If you took blood from the veins of a day laborer while he was working, you would find it full of fatigue toxins and fatigue products. But if you took a drop of blood from the brain of an Albert Einstein, it would show no fatigue toxins whatever at the end of the day. So far as the brain is concerned, it can work as well and as swiftly at the end of 8 or even 12 hours of effort as at the beginning. The brain is utterly tireless. So what makes you tired? Psychiatrists declare that most of our fatigue derives from our mental and emotional attitudes. One of England's most distinguished psychiatrists, A.J. Hadfield, says in his book, The Psychology of Power, "The greater part of the fatigue from which we suffer is of mental origin. In fact, exhaustion of purely physical origin is rare." One of America's most distinguished psychiatrists, Dr. A.A. Brill, goes even further. He declares 100% of the fatigue of the sedentary worker in good health is due to psychological factors, by which we mean emotional factors. What kinds of emotional factors tire the sedentary or sitting worker? Joy? Commitment? No, never. Boredom, resentment, the feeling of not being appreciated, a feeling of futility, hurry, anxiety, worry, those are the emotional factors that exhaust the sitting worker, make him susceptible to colds, reduce his output, and send him home with a nervous headache. Yes, we get tired because our emotions produce nervous tensions in the body. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company pointed that out in a leaflet on fatigue. "Hard work by itself," says this great life insurance company, "seldom causes fatigue which cannot be cured by a good sleep or rest. Worry, tenseness, and emotional upsets are three of the biggest causes of fatigue. Often they're to blame when physical or mental work seems to be the cause. Remember that a tense muscle is a working muscle. Ease up. Save energy for important duties. Stop now, right where you are, and give yourself a checkup." As you read these lines, are you scowling at the book? Are you sitting relaxed in your chair? Or are you hunching up your shoulders? Are the muscles of your face tense? Unless your entire body is as limp and relaxed as an old rag doll, you are at this very moment producing nervous tensions and muscular tensions. You are producing nervous tensions and nervous fatigue. Why do we produce these unnecessary tensions in doing mental work? Daniel W. Joslin says, "I find that the chief obstacle is the almost universal belief that hard work requires a feeling of effort, else it is not well done. So we scowl when we concentrate. We hunch up our shoulders. We call on our muscles to make the motion of effort, which in no way assists our brain in its work." Here's an astonishing and tragic truth. Millions of people who wouldn't dream of wasting dollars go right on wasting and squandering their energy with the recklessness of 7 drunken sailors in Singapore. What is the answer to this nervous fatigue? Relax, relax, relax. Learn to relax while you're doing your work. Easy? No, you'll probably have to reverse the habits of a lifetime. But it is worth the effort, for it may revolutionize your life. William James said in his essay, The Gospel of Relaxation, The American overtension and jerkiness and breathlessness and intensity and agony of expression are bad habits, nothing more or less. Tension is a habit. Relaxing is a habit, and bad habits can be broken, good habits formed. How do you relax? Do you start with your mind or do you start with your nerves? Well, you don't start with either. You always begin to relax with your muscles. Well, let's give it a try. To show how it's done, suppose we start with your eyes. Read this paragraph through, and when you've reached the end, lean back, close your eyes, and say to your eyes silently, "Let go, let go. Stop straining, stop frowning, let go, let go." Repeat this over and over, very slowly, for a minute. Didn't you notice that after a few seconds, the muscles of the eyes began to obey? Didn't you feel as though some hand had wiped away the tension? Well, incredible as it seems, you have sampled in that 1 minute the whole key and secret to the art of relaxing. You can do the same thing with the jaw, with the muscles of the face, with the neck, with the shoulders, the whole of the body. But the most important organ of all is the eye. Dr. Edmund Jacobson of the University of Chicago has gone so far as to say that if you can completely relax the muscles of your eyes, you can forget all your troubles. The reason the eyes are so important in relieving nervous tension is that they burn up 1/4 of all the nervous energies consumed by the body. That is also why so many people with perfectly sound vision suffer from eye strain. They are tensing the eyes. Vicki Baum, the famous novelist, said that when she was a child, she met an old man who taught her one of the most important lessons she ever learned. She had fallen down and cut her knees and hurt her wrist. The old man picked her up. He had once been a circus clown, and as he brushed her off, he said, "The reason you injured yourself was because you don't know how to relax. You have to pretend you are as limp as a sock, an old crumpled sock. Come, I'll show you how to do it." That old man taught Vicki Baum and the other children how to fall, how to do flip-flops, and how to turn somersaults. And he always insisted, "Think of yourself as an old crumpled sock. Then you've got to relax." You can relax in odd moments almost anywhere you are. Only don't make an effort to relax. Relaxation is the absence of all tension and effort. Think ease and relaxation. Begin by thinking relaxation of the muscles of your eyes and your face, saying over and over, "Let go, let go, let go," and relax. Feel the energy flowing out of your facial muscles to the center of your body. Think of yourself as free from tension as a baby. That is what Galacourchi, the great soprano, used to do. Helen Jepson told me that she used to see Galacourchi before a performance, sitting in a chair with all her muscles relaxed and her lower jaw so limp it actually sagged. An excellent practice. It kept her from becoming too nervous before her stage entrance. It prevented fatigue. Here are 4 suggestions that will help you learn to relax. 1. Relax in odd moments. Let your body go limp like an old sock. I keep an old maroon-colored sock on my desk as I work. Keep it there as a reminder of how limp I ought to be. If you haven't got a sock, a cat will do. Did you ever pick up a kitten sleeping in the sunshine? If so, both ends sagged like a wet newspaper. Even the yogis in India say that if you want to master the art of relaxation, study the cat. I never saw a tired cat, a cat with a nervous breakdown, or a cat suffering from insomnia, worry, or stomach ulcers. You will probably avoid these disasters if you learn to relax as the cat does. 2. Work as much as possible in a comfortable position. Remember that tensions in the body produce aching shoulders and nervous fatigue. 3. Check yourself 4 or 5 times a day and say to yourself, "Am I making my work harder than it actually is? Am I using muscles that have nothing to do with the work I'm doing?" This will help you form the habit of relaxing. And as Dr. David Harold Fink says, among those who know psychology best, it is habits 2 to 1. 4. Test yourself again at the end of the day by asking yourself, "Just how tired am I? If I am tired, it's not because of the mental work I have done, but because of the way I have done it. I measure my accomplishments, says Daniel W. Jocelyn, not by how tired I am at the end of the day, but how tired I am not. He says, when I feel particularly tired at the end of the day, or when irritability proves that my nerves are tired, I know beyond question that it has been an inefficient day, both as to quantity and quality. If every businessman in America would learn that same lesson, our death rate from hypertension diseases would drop overnight, and we would stop filling up our sanitariums and asylums with people who have been broken by fatigue and worry. Chapter 25. How to Avoid Fatigue and Keep Looking Young. One day last autumn, my associate flew up to Boston to attend a session of one of the most unusual medical classes in the world. Medical? Well, yes. It meets once a week at the Boston Dispensary, and the patients who attend it get regular and thorough medical examinations before they're admitted. But actually, this class is a psychological clinic. Although it's officially called a class in applied psychology, formerly the thought control class, a name suggested by the first member, its real purpose is to deal with people who are ill from worry, and many of these patients are emotionally disturbed housewives. How did such a class for worriers get started? Well, in 1930, Dr. Joseph H. Pratt, who, by the way, had been a pupil of Sir William Osler, observed that many of the outpatients who came to the Boston Dispensary apparently had nothing wrong with them physically, yet they had practically all the symptoms that flesh is heir to. One woman's hands were so crippled with arthritis that she'd lost all use of them. Another was in agony with all the excruciating symptoms of cancer of the stomach. Others had backaches, headaches, were chronically tired, or had vague aches and pains. They actually felt these pains, but the most exhaustive medical examination showed that nothing whatever was wrong with these people, in the physical sense. Many old-fashioned doctors would have said it was all imagination, all in the mind. But Dr. Pratt realized that it was no use to tell these patients to go home and forget it. He knew that most of these people didn't want to be sick. If it was so easy to forget their ailments, they would do so themselves. So what could be done? He opened this class to a chorus of doubts from the medical doubters on the sidelines, and the class worked wonders. In the years that have passed since it started, thousands of patients have been cured by attending it. Some of the patients have been coming for years, as religious in their attendance as though going to church. My assistant talked to a woman who has hardly missed a session in more than 9 years. She said that when she first went to the clinic, she was thoroughly convinced she had a floating kidney and some kind of heart ailment. She was so worried and tense that she occasionally lost her eyesight and had spells of blindness. Yet today she's confident and cheerful and in excellent health. She looked only about 40, yet she held one of her grandchildren asleep in her lap. "I used to worry so much about my family troubles," she said, "that I wished I could die. But I learned at this clinic the futility of worrying. I learned to stop it, and I can honestly say now that my life is serene." Dr. Rose Hilferding, the medical advisor of the class, said that she thought one of the best remedies for lightening worry is talking your troubles over with someone you trust. "We call it catharsis," she said. "When our patients come here, they can talk their troubles over at length until they get them off their minds. Brooding over worries alone and keeping them to oneself causes great nervous tension. We all have to share our troubles. We have to share worry. We have to feel there is someone in the world who is willing to listen and able to understand." My assistant witnessed the great relief that came to one woman from talking out her worries. She had domestic worries, and when she first began to talk, she was like a wound-up spring. Then, gradually, as she kept on talking, she began to calm down. At the end of the interview, she was actually smiling. Had the problem been solved? No, it wasn't that easy. What caused the change was talking to someone, getting a little advice and a little human sympathy. What had really worked the change was the tremendous healing value that lies in words. Psychoanalysis is based, to some extent, on this healing power of words. Ever since the days of Freud, analysts have known that a patient could find relief from his inner anxieties if he could talk, just talk. Why is this so? Maybe because by talking, we gain a little better insight into our troubles, get a better perspective. No one knows the whole answer, but all of us know that spitting it out or getting it off our chests brings almost instant relief. So the next time we have an emotional problem, why don't we look around for someone to talk to? I don't mean, of course, to go around making pests of ourselves by whining and complaining to everyone in sight. Let's decide on someone we can trust and make an appointment. Maybe a relative, a doctor, a lawyer, a minister or priest. Then say to that person, I want your advice. I have a problem and I wish you'd listen while I put it in words. You may be able to advise me. You may see angles to this thing that I can't see myself. But even if you can't, you'll help me tremendously if you will just sit and listen while I talk it out. Talking things out, then, is one of the principal therapies used at the Boston Dispensary class. But here are some other ideas we picked up at the class, things you can do in your home. 1. Keep a notebook or scrapbook for inspirational reading. Into this book, you can paste all the poems or short prayers or quotations which appeal to you personally and give you a lift. Then, when a rainy afternoon sends your spirits plunging down, perhaps you can find a recipe in this book for dispelling the gloom. Many patients kept such notebooks for years. They said it was a spiritual shot in the arm. 2. Don't dwell too long on the shortcomings of others. One woman at the class who found herself developing into a scolding, nagging, and haggard-faced wife was brought up short with the question, "What would you do if your husband died?" She was so shocked by the idea that she immediately sat down and drew up a list of all her husband's good points. She made quite a list. Why don't you try the same thing the next time you feel you married a tyrant? Maybe you'll find, after reading your spouse's virtues, that he or she is a person you'd like to meet. 3. Get interested in people. Develop a friendly, healthy interest in the people who share your life. One ailing woman who felt herself so exclusive that she hadn't any friends was told to try to make up a story about the next person she met. She began, in the bus, to weave backgrounds and settings for the people she saw. She tried to imagine what their lives had been like. First thing you know, she was talking to people everywhere, and today she's happy, alert, and a charming human being, cured of her pains. 4. Make up a schedule for tomorrow's work before you go to bed tonight. The class found out that many people feel driven and harassed by the unending round of work and things they must do. They never got their work finished. They were chased by the clock. To cure this sense of hurry and worry, the suggestion was made that they draw up a schedule each night for the following day. What happened? More work was accomplished, much less fatigue, a feeling of pride and achievement, and time left over for rest and enjoyment. 5. Finally, avoid tension and fatigue. Relax, relax. Nothing will make you look old sooner than tension and fatigue. Nothing will work such havoc with your freshness and looks. My assistant sat for an hour in the Boston Thought Control class while Professor Paul E. Johnson, the director, went over many of the principles we've already discussed in the previous chapter, the rules for relaxing. At the end of 10 minutes of these relaxing exercises, which my assistant did with the others, she was almost asleep, sitting upright in her chair. Why is such stress laid on this physical relaxing? Because the clinic knows, as other doctors know, that if you're going to get the worry kinks out of people, they've got to relax. Yes, you have got to relax. Strangely enough, a good hard floor is better to relax on than an inner spring bed. It gives more resistance. It's good for the spine. All right, then. Here are some exercises you can do. Try them for a week and see what you do for your looks and disposition. A. Lie flat on the floor whenever you feel tired. Stretch as tall as you can. Roll around if you want to. Do it twice a day. B. Close your eyes. You might try saying, as Professor Johnson recommended, something like this. The sun is shining overhead. The sky is blue and sparkling. Nature is calm and in control of the world. And I, as nature's child, am in tune with the universe. Or, better still, pray. C. If you cannot lie down because you can't spare the time, then you can achieve almost the same effect sitting down in a chair. A hard, upright chair is the best for relaxing. Sit upright in the chair like a seated Egyptian statue, and let your hands rest, palms down, on the tops of your thighs. D. Now, slowly tense the toes, then let them relax. Tense the muscles in your legs, and let them relax. Do this slowly upward with all the muscles of your body until you get to the neck. Then let your head roll around heavily, as though it were a football. Keep saying to your muscles, as in the previous chapter, let go, let go. E. Quiet your nerves with slow, steady breathing. Breathe from deep down. The yogis of India were right. Rhythmical breathing is one of the best methods ever discovered for soothing the nerves. F. Think of all the wrinkles and frowns in your face and smooth them all out. Loosen up the worry creases you feel between your brows and at the sides of your mouth. Do this twice a day, and maybe you won't have to go to a health club to get a massage. Maybe the lines will disappear from the inside out. Chapter 26. Four good working habits that will help prevent fatigue and worry. Good working habit number one. Clear your desk of all papers except those relating to the immediate problem at hand. Roland L. Williams, president of Chicago and Northwestern Railway, once said, "A person with his desk piled high with papers on various matters will find his work much easier and more accurate if he clears that desk of all but the immediate problem on hand. I call this good housekeeping, and it's the number one step toward efficiency." If you visit the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., you will find five words painted on the ceiling, five words written by the poet Pope. Order is heaven's first law. Order ought to be the first law of business, too. But is it? No. The average desk is cluttered up with papers that haven't been looked at for weeks. In fact, the publisher of a New Orleans newspaper once told me that his secretary cleared up one of his desks and found a typewriter that had been missing for 2 years. The mere sight of a desk littered with unanswered mail and reports and memos is enough to breed confusion, tensions, and worries. It is much worse than that. The constant reminder of a million things to do and no time to do them can worry you not only into tension and fatigue, but it can also worry you into high blood pressure, heart trouble, and stomach ulcers. Dr. John H. Stokes, professor, Graduate School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania, read a paper before the National Convention of the American Medical Association, a paper entitled Functional Neuroses as Complications of Organic Disease. In that paper, Dr. Stokes listed 11 conditions under the title What to Look For in the Patient's State of Mind. Now, here's the first item on that list. The sense of must or obligation, the unending stretch of things ahead that simply have to be done. But how can such an elementary procedure as clearing your desk and making decisions help you avoid this high pressure, this sense of must, this sense of an unending stretch of things ahead that simply have to be done? Dr. William L. Sadler, the famous psychiatrist, told of a patient who, by using this simple device, avoided a nervous breakdown. The man was an executive in a big Chicago firm. When he came to Dr. Sadler's office, he was tense, nervous, worried. He knew he was heading for a tailspin, but he couldn't quit work. He had to have help. While this man was telling me his story, Dr. Sadler says, my telephone rang. It was the hospital calling. And instead of deferring the matter, I took time right then to come to a decision. I always settle questions, if possible, right on the spot. I'd no sooner hung up than the phone rang again. Again, an urgent matter which I took time to discuss. The third interruption came when a colleague of mine came into my office for advice on a patient who was critically ill. When I'd finished with him, I turned to my caller and began to apologize for keeping him waiting. But he'd brightened up. He had a completely different look on his face. Don't apologize, doctor, this man said to Sadler. In the last 10 minutes, I think I've got a hunch as to what's wrong with me. I'm going back to my office and revise my working habits. But before I go, do you mind if I take a look in your desk? Dr. Sadler opened up the drawers of his desk. All